Bill James always talked about that's how players become underrated, like Dwight Evans in the 80s, good at a lot of different things. We didn't have a glittering stat.
Welcome to episode 40 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball perspectives fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Ginella and Mauricio Rubio. Joining us this week for our episode 40 is friend of the podcast and man about Yahoo, as I'm sure you know, Scott Pienowski. A small welcome to Mao and Mike. A large welcome to Scott. So, Scott, thank you for coming on. How are things?
I'm doing great. My pleasure to talk with you guys. Two people I greatly respect and enjoy. And now the football's just about done. I mean, I know to you guys, baseball is a 12-month-a-year thing, but to me, I have to segment my life a little bit and compartmentalize. But now that football has basically passed the baton, it's baseball all the time. I can't wait to get some snow melted and start talking about the season.
Yeah. Well, we're about to get, you know, we have a propensity to talk about the weather at the beginning of the podcast, and we're in the middle of Mike and I are in the middle of the most recent snowpocalypse. So we'll see. It might take a while for this to melt. So, although it hasn't, has it started up by you, Mike?
Just a little bit. You know, from what I've seen, it looks like, I don't say it's going to be a dud, but it looks like it's going to start later and end earlier than it was supposed to. So hopefully we only get like 8 to 10 inches.
Yeah. That wouldn't be bad. You in Chicago have it easy this time.
Yeah, I know. Well, we got it last year pretty heavy, and only 8 to 10 would have been really, really nice.
See, Scott, we weren't kidding. We actually do talk about the weather at the beginning of almost every show.
I'm curious to think how well, like, a weather correspondent would do on this show, like if we actually had somebody to kick it out to.
I feel like it would be redundant.
Good point.
Well, it's kind of funny that you say weather, because a lot of times fantasy pundits are accused of being weathermen. You know, good or bad. The idea is that when you're right, nobody goes to the weatherman and says, "Hey, great call. You said it was going to be 83 and sunny, and it was 83 and sunny." But whenever they get it wrong, you know, the snowstorm doesn't hit, or it's supposed to be sunny and it rains. Oh, those guys, they're just guessing. They never get it right. So I always felt like my colleague Brad Evans, my esteemed Yahoo colleague Brad Evans, I believe wanted to be a meteorologist growing up. If you ever had him on the program, you can probably talk weather for 55 minutes and baseball for 5 minutes. Brad would probably prefer it that way anyway. But yeah, he was going to be a meteorologist at one point in his life, and then I guess he decided more utility for the world if he went into fantasy sports.
Yeah, I get that. We're not useful at all, though. We don't try to predict the weather. We just complain about the weather.
Yeah, we're after the fact.
So we're the worst kind of weather fantasy analysts. So let's get the initial pleasantries out of the way. You can read us at baseballperspectives.com. You can read Scott at yahoo.com. You can find all of us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. Mao is at MRubio52. And Scott is at Scott_Pienowski. That's P-I-A-N-O-W-S-K-I. You can email us as a podcast, flagsflyforever@baseballperspectives.com. And we ask that you rate and review us, on iTunes or the Stitcher Radio app, since it does, fancy SEO things, I think. So we're going to start with our topic of the week, and we are getting close enough to the regular season that we can actually start to have some real fun with early ADP data. So we look to the scribes who participate in NFBC and take a look and see what What we find interesting at this point in the year, obviously it's still late January. Things are going to move a lot between now and when your draft probably is. But let's just kind of go around and pick out a couple of guys who we are a little confused as to whether they're too high, too low, or what we think. We'll throw it out to Mike first. What's one guy that really pops out to you when you're looking at this data at this point?
Well, I think the first guy who just absolutely jumps out at me, and I think I see two trends, but I don't want to steal, you know, everybody, you know, so I'll just mention one guy. And, you know, right off the bat, that's Tanaka. I understand, you know, this is, you know, Masahiro Tanaka with the Yankees. I understand some of the excitement with him. He was great before the injury last year, but he's trying to rehab as opposed to going the surgical route. Now, I know there's some injuries, like Jurickson Profar's injury, for example, the teres muscle, that's a rehab, surgery is the last resort. And in fact, a surgery, if you're getting the surgery, is really bad news. You know, in Tanaka's case, we kind of know that I think the rehab has worked like once. Pitchers that have tried it have ultimately had to get the surgery. Now, I get it. You know, I get that you're supposed to do rehab before you go that route. But all that being said, you know, I kind of look at where Tanaka's going. You know, he's going, I think, on average, you know, at about 136. That's like a 12th round pick in a 15 team league. It's obviously higher. I have him a lot lower than that. I'm just really skeptical. I'm kind of looking at a number three, maybe number four from him, and the value there is kind of higher. I'm just really skeptical he's going to return that value.
All right. Yeah, Tanaka is just one of those guys that is a pretty much a pure risk proposition at this point. I mean, there was no question he was excellent when he was healthy, but that is an awful lot of risk to take, especially in a deeper mixed league. It could be rather dangerous. But I mean, do we think the risk is that much higher with Tanaka than with Cliff Lee, who's probably Lee is what, maybe 20? I think he's 20 spots behind him. I'm not quite at that part of the.
He's closer to, I think it's like 35. Yeah, it's about 35 slots. I think the risk with Lee might be about the same. I just think that it, you know, and again, it's that slotting thing. You're talking about three more rounds in a mix, and I think that makes some difference. I also think Lee is too high. It's just that Tanaka really, really jumps out, and I think some of it is, I'm guessing in a couple months Tanaka's going to be getting that surgery, if I had to make an educated guess.
All right. Scott, what about you? What name or names jump out as being in a different spot than you would have guessed prior to looking at it?
By the way, I agree with what you guys were saying on Tanaka. I'll start with that. You know, Adam Jones is interesting to me. I'm looking at NFBC ADP data. I see he's around pick 15, pick 16. I think he's been consistent enough to be a first round pick. And my feeling is I just want to get on base with that first round pick, put a cornerstone down. And I see some guys in the first round who haven't done it multiple seasons. A guy, you know, Jose Altuve has not been a first round player before until last year. Terrific year. You know, Anthony Rendon, his first year at that level. I just want to be safe with those early picks. So to me, Adam Jones is somebody I'd be very comfortable at the end of a first round. I'm surprised he's going a little bit later than I thought he would. And also Madison Bumgarner, this sounds so elementary. The guy has a lights out postseason. You think, oh, well, some people say, oh, he'll be overpriced next year. And I like to think that fantasy owners are more sophisticated than that. But in this case, maybe they're not. His overall ADP is 25 right now. And to me, I don't like to take pitching early in any league anyway, but maybe this reflects that NFBC people feel they have to be more aggressive with starting pitching early on. But still, he's only had one 200 strikeout season. He's always been on the fringe of being a top 10 starter. I don't think he has the body of work. I think this is pricing in his October heroics. It sounds elementary, and it sounds like we should be smarter than that, but I think Bumgarner's going around earlier than he should.
I completely agree with you on Bumgarner. We touched on a little bit of this last week when we talked about Max Scherzer, but the fact that Bumgarner's going seven, eight spots ahead of Scherzer is kind of mind bending to me. I mean, yeah.
Can I ask Scott a question about Jones? I agree with you, but I just wanted to bring something up. You know, I know like Chris Liss of RotoWire, for example, has the opposite mentality that you do, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And his belief on someone like Jones, you know, we both respect Chris, you know, and he's very smart.
Sure.
Crazy like a fox. You know, his belief on someone like Jones is I'd rather have the guy with the ceiling in a mix, you know, even if it's somebody who I know is going to miss, you know, say 20 games, 30 games. You know, and these are guys last year that flamed out, but he's mentioned guys like Carlos Gonzalez, Troy Tulowitzki, because if they perform at the elite level in a mixed league, I can get that replacement player for those 30 games. Whereas Jones or, you know, someone like Hunter Pence, yeah, they're going to play almost every game, but they're producing while at a very good level. There's never that opportunity to sub someone in. So I just kind of want to get your feelings on that. Again, I agree with you. You're preaching the choir. But I just kind of want to get your feelings on, like, Liss's thought when it comes to that draft theory.
Yeah, you know, you, Chris is a longtime friend of mine, certainly somebody I respect. And, you know, the guys at RotoWire work great, so I'm all in favor of those people. Chris and I actually had an interesting debate on his program, on a serious program last year, centered around Adam Jones and Bryce Harper. And the whole point was, you know, Jones was the boring floor guy. Harper was the buzzy upside guy. And, you know, okay, Harper got hurt last year. I actually think Harper has dipped down this year to the point that he's a really nice value. I'm all for at some point going to the upside mode, playing to win the league, not worrying about the risk so much. I just don't want to do it with my first pick. And that's why Jones to me, and also the games played column, a lot of this has to deal with the size of your league and what the replacement value is like. If you're in a shallower mixed league, it doesn't really matter how much risk you're taking on sometimes because you can get really good players at any position at any time. But as you start to get the deeper mixed with people who know what they're doing and some of these leagues you can't trade to maybe offset an injury or a position that you need to fill, in that case, somebody showing up for 150-plus games a season, which Jones, health is the skill when you've displayed it several years in a row, as Jones has done, and Pence for that matter. Pence is one of my favorite players in a few rounds later because he's good at so many different things, but he's not outstanding in any one area. Bill James always talked about that's how players become underrated, like Dwight Evans in the 80s, good at a lot of different things. We didn't have a glittering stat. There's no black ink in certain areas. All he did get on base a ton. People didn't appreciate it as much at the time. But I guess I'm a boring floor guy. There's nothing wrong with the Liss approach. If you hit right, if anybody gets Troy Tulowitzki this year and he plays 145 games, I'm sure you're going to be thrilled because he'll probably be an MVP candidate. But in the first round, I'm always going to be a floor guy. And to me, Adam Jones fits that in the first round.
Yeah, you're preaching in the choir with me, Scott. I miss you in Tout Wars in the NL, but I'm also glad you're not there because we usually bumped heads.
So I'll throw out next, and you know, Scott teased at it when he was talking before, but I want to talk about where Bryce Harper is. Bryce Harper is at 34 right now, versus I want to say off the top of my head, his ADP last year was around 12. Does that sounds about right to you guys?
He was a first rounder, I thought. I mean, so.
Yeah, he was maybe 13 or 14, but he was somewhere in there.
Yeah,
so, I mean, I could pull it up if you really want to know, but he was.
No, I just want to make sure I wasn't completely off. But you know, Harper really strikes me as a guy who, I mean, do people really feel that differently about Harper this year than they did last year? It's Harper without the uncontrollable excitement, right? Harper is still, you know, we still believe, I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think we still believe that Harper has all the tools to be a superstar and a absolute fantasy superstar. But he also has the risk of, you know, being an injury guy and not having, you know, that strong track record of performance. So that dip of, you know, nearly two rounds really turns him into quite a value there. And the guy who's, you know, oddly enough right next to him is Yasiel Puig, who's at 33. You know, talk about sort of the anti Bumgarner, right? Puig had a great season, and then the story of the postseason was, hey, he sucks. And
his manager sucks. That's what really sucks there. And by the way, maybe Bryce Harper's does too.
It's quite possible. So those two guys, you know, I think are pretty heavily undervalued considering what they're capable of at this point. And I have a feeling that they will creep up as we get closer to the season. But do any of you guys disagree with me on where these two are and where you guys would feel comfortable taking them?
Are you asking me or Scott?
Either of you guys.
Scott's our guest. We can let him go first.
I have a couple different feelings on Harper. I do think if he's going to go in the third round, he feels like he's entirely upside at that point. Get a little nervous that he hasn't hit for a plus fantasy average yet, or I guess if he get his career average 272, he's actually been very consistent, 270, 274, 273 the last 3 years. Last year he didn't run much, only 2 stolen bases. But if somebody said to me, over under Bryce Harper, MVPs for his career, a half, I would take the over on that. Or if I think, do I think Bryce Harper will be a top 10 drafted player in one of the next 2 or 3 years? I think there's an excellent chance he will be. It's just going back to what Brett said. Everything that we liked about him last year, I think, is still in play. And as you think of a player, I mean, what is he now? He's going to be 20, he's only going into his age 22 season. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in a lot of cases, a lot of players with his pedigree would still be in the minors or coming into a rookie year. He has all this experience now, gotten broken in a little bit with Matt Williams. I hope Matt Williams will just realize, look, if Harper has a hamstring injury, don't bust on him if he's not running down a infield grounder. I mean, it's just so silly. But I guess just the case of everything we liked about Harper last year still applies. And I thought he'd settle in as like maybe a late second round pick. I'm shocked that I've seen third round, fourth round, fifth round for him in some mocks or in some early drafts. That doesn't make sense to me, even though I think I'm more risk averse in early rounds than most people. Third or fourth round, that's sounding really enticing to me. I think that's a tremendous value right now.
To me, Harper and Puig are kind of two different cases. First of all, I agree with just about everything Scott said on Harper, and this is the recency bias that we see, which is people, you know, Brett and I took Giancarlo Stanton in the second round in labor last year, which was one of the few things that went right for us. And part of that was he was overvalued, which, you know, I think everyone here remembers in 2013. He was going in the middle of the first round. And then all of a sudden he was dropping to the end of the second, beginning of the third. And, you know, Brett and I were like, well, I get it. Like, you know, there's some issues with him, but he's got that power to hit 35, 40 home runs. So I think that's kind of what we're seeing more with Puig. You know, Puig's a guy, I think expectations were too high last year. He was going way up there. You know, I saw him going in the second round in a lot of drafts, even late first for some really aggressive drafters. He didn't really have a down year. You know, he had the power was down a little bit, but overall he kind of put up that profile of numbers you'd expect. And he's another guy, you know, he's young. He's not as young as Harper, obviously, but he's still kind of that raw player I think can make a big jump, and people are undervaluing him a little bit at their peril. Harper, well, I agree with all that, and I think in the long term is going to be a superstar. My only concern with Harper is that, and this is just a general concern, when there's a player that gets injured and misses time, but the level of production's the same, I don't really think much of it. I think, well, whatever, you know, he could be healthy again. He might not be healthy. One of the biggest fallacies I always see is the assumption that someone will always be hurt. You know, Matt Kemp last year, Jason Worth, Jacoby Ellsbury. There's a long list of players. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, you know, that guy's going to be hurt. He's going to be hurt. And you kind of lose out assuming that. But Harper last year, it wasn't just he was hurt. It was that the production per at bat or plate appearance was lower. So that's kind of where the alarm went off a little bit for me. And I'm not saying to go crazy and downgrade him and, you know, push him down to the fourth or fifth round. But I do think that it's more the argument the other way. If you're pushing him up to a second round value thinking, well, you know, he was a late first round, you know, last year. This year he's a second rounder. I don't think this is a Giancarlo Stanton situation in 2014 where he's getting pushed way too far down. I think he's getting pushed a little too far down, if that makes any sense.
Well, that makes sense. I was going to bring up the exact same thing, the Stanton thing from last year, because I think it's a really good corollary. I mean, obviously it's not a complete apples to apples situation, but I think it's a strong thing to remember as you're looking at this. Mal, is anything jump out at you?
Yeah, I want to talk about two guys actually, and they're, you know, I'm going to talk about them in kind of a related manner. But the first guy I want to talk about is Javier Baez, and the second guy I want to talk about is JD Martinez. Now, just going off of NFBC data, because Baez's stock is kind of all over the place right now. He had a lot of hype coming into 2014 and started off okay, but ran into some really severe strikeout problems that, you know, took the shine out of his stock a little bit. So, you know, in NFBC, he's taken around the 100th and 11th pick, and JD Martinez is getting taken in at about the 113th pick, which, you know, I think that the stock arrow coming out of 2014 for both of these players is kind of the complete opposite that it was coming into 2014. So, you know, given the choice between the two players, and I do kind of want to go around the horn here, which one are you taking in 2015? Are you taking Baez or are you taking Martinez, Brett?
If it's a mixed league, I'm taking Baez. There's just too much fun there for that point in the draft. And I think he has the talent to take a step forward. I don't think there's really much getting in the way of him getting the playing time unless he just absolutely bombs. Scott, what about you?
You know, I would take JD Martinez. I also wonder if Martinez might be cheaper in some leagues, because a lot of times what I like to call the regression police, when they see a season that's an outlier that's unlikely to repeat for whatever reason, some people just go so far in the other direction and just almost cross the player off their list before a draft starts. I think JD Martinez, the smarter your league is, the more likely you'll get him at a nice price, because people are so worried about being the sucker on JD Martinez that they just let him slide too far. But I know that the question is, if they were at an even price, I would still take Martinez in that situation.
It's Martinez for me as well. I am particularly for 2015. I get the upside on Baez. It isn't even endorsed to Martinez. I'm really scared of Baez this year. I know strikeouts are up league-wide, but a 41.5% strikeout rate, it just sends off bells. And, you know, historically, I can't think of too many guys, even if you adjust for era, who have succeeded. You know, the guys I think about are guys like Mark Reynolds, like Russell Branyan, who maybe had a couple good seasons here and there, but flamed out. And I'm not saying he's going to have the bias. I mean, he's a top talent. I get it. But there are a lot of questions of me coming in this year. If he starts out in the minors or is up for a month and goes to the minors, I don't think that should surprise anybody. I think he needs some work. I don't want to say the Cubs rush him because the numbers in AAA were certainly fine. But he just doesn't look like somebody to me right now who's going to succeed. Now, I know the Cubs were working on his swing, so this is one of those caveats where he could walk into spring training and look like a different hitter, and I could be completely wrong, you know, as I'm talking in, you know, late January.
I think Baez is probably one of the most interesting players, both from a fantasy perspective and a real life perspective, because the thing with Baez is that the scouting report out on him has been out so long. Like, we've been talking about this guy for quite a while now, ever since he was even in low A, you know, down in Peoria when they were still down there. And I mean, the reports, you know, remain consistently the same. It's you know, he's overly aggressive at the plate. You can get him out with soft stuff away. So it's, you know, I think I lean Martinez here, but, you know, there's the two extreme outcomes with Baez, the one where he gets sent down to AAA and the one where he just kind of breaks out and has a, you know, it's a 20 to 25 home run season while carrying probably around a 250 or 240 average. I think both of those things are still in play. And if you're getting that with shortstop eligibility, I can see the argument for him. It's a scary profile. I mean, no doubt, but it's, yeah, I can kind of see where you'd come from in taking Baez.
If I could jump in and say one other thing, just as my drafting style, I'm not trying to beat people to the punch on younger players. In the case of Baez, if he's buzzy at all in the spring, I'm just going to shrug and say, you know, he hit 169 last year in 52 games. He struck out 95 times in the third of a season. I have no problem. If people want to beat me by projecting significant improvement in young players, like a guy who's 21, 22 years old, and leave me the boring players who have maybe already established a level, or the players like J.D. Martinez, people don't want to trust. I mean, look, if Baez has such a huge pedigree, and I'm thrilled with the Chicago organization. I can't wait to see where this Cubs team goes. I'm a big Theo Epstein fan. As a guy who grew up in Boston, I feel like I owe a lot to Epstein for validating my adulthood and all that. But so Baez obviously should be a terrific player someday. Chris Bryant should be a terrific player someday. They have so many. Addison Russell should be a terrific player someday. I expect the Cubs will win a World Series be in a World Series in the next 8 to 10 years, maybe sooner than that. I fully believe in the organization long term. But short term, I'm not going to jump in front of anybody to draft Baez this season. I can almost guarantee he won't.
Yeah, you stole my point too, Scott, which is I think all these Cubs, with the exception of Soler, are overvalued to me right now. Baez, Bryant, Alcantara, I get it, you know, and I get what the Cubs are doing. And you're right, you know, Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer, it's just a terrific job they've done there. You know, I just think, like, the Sporting News predicting them to win the World Series or get to the World Series this year.
Yeah, it was not good.
Is just, you know, I know some of that Back to the Future 2 thing, but it's just hyper aggressive, and it's making, you know, you're right, Scott, it's like, let somebody else pay 18 to 20 in an auction for Baez, or let them take him in the 11th or 12th round. It's a different story, obviously, in Dynasty or Keeper, which, you know, is a good portion of our audience, but, you know, for the redraft conversation, I kind of agree with you. I feel like let somebody else take the risk with those guys, and unless you're talking a 10-team mixed, there I can see the argument for Baez over Martinez if you're, you know, looking at upside versus, like, boring predictability.
Yeah, and that's totally fair. And I actually like Martinez. I just, Baez is one of those guys who has the specialness in his bat. And at that price, where you're talking about outside the top 100 for a guy who's looking at playing time, and you know, I think the strikeout rate from last year is elevated for a number of reasons. I think it's higher than what we should expect going forward. I think he's always going to strike out. I think he's more of a 30% strikeout rate guy, which is certainly workable with his power and his speed. I mean, people forget. I mean, he not only hit 37 homers in the minors in 2013, but he also stole 20 bases. There's a lot that he can do, but there's very little he can't do. And at that price, that's sort of where the tipping scale is. I mean, I like Arizmendi Alcantara as much as most people, but you know, he's probably a guy I'm not going to own very much this year, just because his upside is good. Baez's upside is intense. For lack of a better word.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
I guess is there anyone else wants to throw out before we move into our position of the week?
I think we hit on the two trends, which were rookies and Cubs in particular, and pitchers coming off an injury. I would just add the other pitcher I'm kind of skeptical of in that vein is Matt Harvey. I get it. And we talked about this last week too. You know, we kind of made the Adam Wainwright coming off of injury 2012 comp. Wainwright was really solid in 2012, but the ERA was high and numbers are good. You know, people are kind of, I think, paying for Harvey like he's going to put up like 85 to 90% of his 2013. And we don't know. Again, I get the risk reward, but it just seems like a lot to me.
Yeah, I'm never going to be that guy again who's going to assume. Well, this is the big thing with me also, especially in fantasy football too, is I'll do rankings in season for fantasy baseball or fantasy football. And a lot of times I just don't want to rank the injured guys, but I'll just shrug and say, okay, I'll give you courtesy injury rankings, but I know I'm going to expect less than most of the fantasy public. I just don't expect miracle comebacks. And we know that Tommy John surgery is – very favorable with the modern science, but it doesn't mean that the guy has to be great right away. And also, well, the team has every incentive to go slower with somebody's timetable, and maybe the Mets aren't contending this year. So why does Harvey need to throw more than, you know, a modest amount of innings? I'm very surprised that his ADP has rebounded as quickly as it has.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing too is this isn't like 10 or 12 years ago when pitching was scarce and, you know, or 15 years ago when you had Pedro and like such a big legion of pitchers way below him. We're in such a pitching thick era, you know, it's the idea that, well, why even gamble on Harvey at that level when there's so many guys going below him who actually produced last year?
No, that's a great point. And also something that our mutual friend Mike Salfino says a lot. One of the great things about taking pitching later is it seems like there's more divergence of opinion on pitchers.
Yeah.
So you're more likely to find that you happen to like a bunch of guys that maybe other people don't like, or you just – it's if you wait on – you're always afraid, oh, what if everybody's waiting on the same guys I am? But it seems like for whatever reason in pitching, that doesn't seem to be the case as much.
Almost never happens. I'm usually in a 12-team mixed mock. I'm happy with like three of my four last pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't we take a quick break and we'll come back and jump into third baseman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to episode 40, Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. We are back with our guest, Scott Pianowski of Yahoo. So as we've been doing the past couple of weeks, we are going to dive into our weekly position, which is third base. So before we get into the 2015 tiers, we are going to take a look back at some interesting things we learned from valuation in 2014. So we'll start with the American League as we've been doing. Mike, since they're your valuations, I will kick it out to you first. What did you notice in putting these together that is at least something you'll take with you going forward?
Well, I think for starters, we kind of talk about the two leagues, and this is sort of our one thing we do a little bit for our mono or really deep listeners on these segments. The American League last year was just a lot stronger on the whole. You had five guys in AL only crack, you know, $20 or more in earnings. You know, one of those guys we won't see at the position in 2015 in Miggy Cabrera, who earned 32. You know, and Miggy just jumped out. And, you know, some of this is the contextual issue we've talked about. You know, a few years ago, 25 home runs and no steals would not have been a 30-plus earner in mono formats. Now we just know it is. You know, we just know because of the lack of big-time production across the board, you know, that even though Miggy had a down year, he still was, and I think in mixed he was 11th overall, in AL only he was 6th. He was still just an elite player. The other thing that really jumps out is there were a lot of guys who, they weren't great, but in deeper mixed and mono formats, they were just productive. You know, David Freese, Trevor Plouffe, Lonnie Chisenhall. These aren't necessarily players that I would want to, you know, rely on in a 10 or 12 team mix. But again, in those deeper formats, while those numbers don't look really exciting, those are the kind of players that third base, and, you know, we'll see this when we jump over the National League, that you kind of have to have, you know, even as an injury replacement to just kind of rely on at some point. You know, I think the other thing I'd say is in those mixed leagues, and I think I mentioned this today on Monday in our State of Position article, you definitely want to try to have two first basemen, you know, in a mixed league as your corners, as opposed to two third basemen.
I absolutely agree with that. Scott, any thoughts on the AL third base crop from last year?
Yeah, I'm just excited to see Josh Donaldson move to a good park. He was an interesting player last year where some people talked about him as an MVP candidate because he did really well in some of the advanced metrics, in part because his park, you know, the way those things are baked, the big park, it ends up making his numbers look better than they really were. And I'm just excited to see him in Toronto. And I think this year is a season where I agree with you guys. Your corner is probably going to be a first baseman. And even though I like the depth of the, maybe the top 6, 8 or 10 third baseman thinking mixed league wise, after that, it just seems like it drops off a cliff, and you're looking at guys that don't want a roster. So I feel pretty confident in a lot of mixed leagues. One of my first four or five picks, I'm not a position scarcity guy in that. I try not to force picks just in a vacuum of, okay, I have to pick a guy here, but I think I'll be using an early pick on a third baseman in a lot of leagues.
Yeah, just scanning. I mean, the top five names were in the guys who all broke the $20 barrier, we're all pretty familiar with, but the names after that are guys that are not going to make people particularly comfortable. Guys like Lonnie Chisenhall and Trevor Plouffe, you know, Brock Holt, Connor Gillespie. These are not fantasy household names for good reason. So I echo those sentiments about where your corner is going to come from and possibly moving a couple of these guys up a tick on draft boards. Mal, anything from you before we hit the National League?
I remain mystified by however it is that Brock Holt did what he did last year. You touched on him a little bit, but this is something that we've been talking about. But like the 280 average with empty power and 12 stolen bases is a $15 earner. And that guy came out of like straight out of nowhere and just produced pretty well. I mean, him and Connor Gillespie are the two guys that I'm just really surprised by on this list, because heading into the season, neither one of those two would have. I probably would not have expected $10+ seasons out of them.
Yeah, and just to point out to Scott, and to people, who may be listening for the first time, that's mono leagues, but that still is, eighth and ninth best in AL only with those numbers really is still eye-opening.
Yep.
Yeah. So then that brings us to the other side of the coin in the National League, where we had exactly one player that earned $20, and that was Todd Frazier, who earned $30. The guy who jumps out to me, and this is part of the same thing that we've talked about the whole time. We've gone through these evaluations. It's Justin Turner, the Dodgers, hit .340 in almost 300 at bats, and almost that alone was enough to give him the same value as Aramis Ramirez, who is a personal favorite of mine even as he ages. But Turner, that the .340 average is crazy high, and he's gonna be looking at a utility role again this year, but it's guys like that you don't expect to just jump out and earn that kind of value. Really helped salvage at least some guys like him and Luis Valbuena and Juan Uribe. It protected third base from being an absolute chasm in the National League, but it almost was anyway.
I think that and that this kind of goes to Scott's point about wanting to get a guy early at third base even if you're not playing the scarcity game. The other side of that coin is that there's players like Valbuena and Turner, and you can't necessarily rely on them coming out of nowhere, but there always seems to be a handful of players that do wind up producing some value. We talked about first base this year and how bad those players were, in terms of replacements that, came up. I think CJ Cron, who was fine over, whatever amount of plate appearances he had, was at the top. And, the National League was a similar story. It was like one or two players that made an impact. There were just more of these guys in both the AL and the NL. I think some of it is, more athleticism, some players who could kind of adapt and maybe were playing other positions in the minors or elsewhere. So that is kind of supports Scott's point to me that I kind of like the top of this position, say 8, maybe 10 guys. Beyond that, I don't really want to overreach just because I don't want to grab a guy who, is going to kind of produce at a middling level when I know there's going to be somebody there later who maybe I can't even identify right now who's going to be productive later.
Yeah, there's no shortage of guys who are going to be very middling at this position.
Yeah.
So, speaking of guys who are middling at the position, we'll jump to the opposite end of the spectrum. We'll move into the 2015 tiers. Starting at the top, these tiers, as we have been doing the whole off-season. These are tiers by a singular BP author, but they take into account some of the opinions of the staff. So this week's tiers were written by Craig Goldstein, and they're up as you're listening to this at baseballperspectus.com. There is exactly one five-star guy, and we started to touch on him before. But we'll go back to Scott. Do you agree that he's in, even if it's not a huge gap after him, that he's sort of in a tier by himself at this point at the position?
And we're talking about Josh Donaldson, and yeah. Very excited to see him in Toronto. You know, it's funny, you look at some of the guys who are below him, and there's age concerns, there's some physical concerns, some guys haven't maybe performed for the last couple of years. And Donaldson, even though he wasn't crushed in Oakland, you want to just look and see that the splits are enough to be excited. It's okay, the average was 19 points lower for his career, the OBP was 31 points lower, the slugging was 32 points lower. So to me, that sounds like I wouldn't take Donaldson in the first round of a mixer, but I think he's a very solid second round pick. And I think now that Cabrera in most leagues, I think Cabrera actually might be a third baseman in Yahoo. I got to double check on that. But in most leagues, I have no problem with Donaldson being the number one third baseman.
Cabrera is third base in Yahoo, according to at least one of our readers today who commented on that. So I'm going to go with yes.
Yeah, I believe it's 10 appearances or 5 starts, and I think he made the 5 starts last year.
He had eight starts.
Okay. Yeah. So enjoy your Miguel Cabrera third base at Yahoo.
Yeah, but just to say, I think we go off of 20, and I know Tout Wars, for example, uses 15. Yahoo is, I believe, the exception.
We're liberal.
Yeah. which is fine. As far as rules go, whatever makes you happy, you know, I'm all for it.
Sure.
So that brings us to the 4-star tier, and we have a lot of familiar names here, even though some of them are going to be less popular than in years past. And then we have a couple of guys who have jumped up into the fray. So between Kyle Seager and Todd Frazier, who is the guy that you all are most confident can maintain the gains that he's made over the past year or the past year or two in Seager's case? We'll start with Mal this time.
I'm going to go with Todd Frazier almost strictly only because he plays in the Great American Ballpark. So it's, you know, I really appreciate what Kyle Seager's done over the past 2 years, and kind of he's become a very productive third baseman, and I think he's going to remain that. But I think Frazier's got the better chance. I feel better about, you know, what he's going to be doing moving forward just because of the park.
All right. Scott, what about you?
Yeah, I think I trust Seager a little bit more, only because with Frazier, we're looking at somebody who gained 39 batting points and 14 stolen bases last year. I just don't know what to do with those 20 stolen bases. And remember, he was just a 19 homer guy the two previous seasons too. There was such a jump up for Frazier, and it came from a guy who never seemed to have a heavy pedigree that there's a case of I don't want to buy. I talked earlier about, I think with JD Martinez, people are going to doubt what he did and you'll get a discount there. I'm just nervous. There was such a jump from Frazier, and it seems like stuff that I couldn't have predicted. Nobody predicted he'd hit 273. A lot of times stealing bases is just wanting to do it. Keith Hernandez has said that anybody could steal 15 bases if they wanted to. The bags are there. You just go and take them. But I'm nervous. To me, Seager, I think, has beaten the park enough. He has enough of a resume in Seattle that I'm not paranoid about him there either. So I lean towards Seager.
Mike?
It's Frazier for me, and I'm sure I've told this story on the show. I know I've told Brett and Mal this story, but I'll share it with Scott. So I was at a AAA game last year with the ESPN guys, with Eric Carabel and Tristan Cockcroft, and this was right after the Major League All-Star game. You know, so most people at the All-Star game are interviewing like Derek Jeter and, you know, all the big stars, and, you know, Eric and, you know, Saris of Fangraphs are going and interviewing the fantasy guys. So they're interviewing Tyson Ross, you know, interviewing Todd Frazier, and some of the senior guys like Jason Stark are like, you know, why are you talking to them? Like, who cares? You know, so they're talking to Frazier, and I forget if it was Eric or Eno, but they're like, why are you stealing bases? And Frazier's like, well, he's like, every offseason, you know, I drink beer, you know, because it was the offseason, I'd relax. And he's like, I made a decision. I was like, you know, this ties your points, guys. Like, I know I could run. I did in the minors, and in the minors is in better shape. So I'm going to stop drinking beer in the offseason. So he made it, you know, this sounds kind of funny, but he kind of made a commitment to being in better shape and being a little bit lighter and to running again. So I don't know if he's going to steal 20, but I'm counting on 10 to 15 from Frazier. And I think he's enough of an all-around player that even if he's not a big-time average guy, I still think he's going to maintain enough of what he did last year and provide in that category to be worth it.
You know, I want to piggyback on that really quickly. In spring training, we'll see a bunch of stories about players who come to camp in great shape and the best shape of his life, and it's a meme and people make fun of it, and there'll be a bunch of blogs about it. But why is it? What's wrong with being in shape? And why is that a bad thing for a player? I love it. There's a great example from fantasy football where Le'Veon Bell came to Steelers camp, bulked up, and added a bunch of muscle. He played really light. I'm sorry, he trimmed down, actually. He lost like maybe 15 or 20 pounds from his rookie year when he played kind of heavy and end up having a breakout year. I don't see – Grant, it's easy to attribute these things after the fact, but I think people – I think we've gone too far with mocking the best shape of his life and forgotten that it's actually a good thing to be in shape.
Yeah.
Sometimes leads the players breaking through.
I think – I agree, Scott. I think the problem often is it when you hear it from everybody, it becomes like you know, like sleeper or buy low. It becomes one of those buzzwords in fantasy where you're like, well – like, you're right. Like, there are players that surely come into camp in really good shape and are committed and, you know, into their craft. But when you hear it about, say, you know, 60% of the baseball population, it's just hard to know. Like, that's why I think you wind up throwing out, like, well, I'm sure some of these players are in the best shape of their life, but I don't have a way of applying fantasy value to that.
Yeah, and that's absolutely a fair point. For completeness, I will choose Seager, but acknowledging that Frazier has the higher upside, I have more comfort in Seager's floor than Frazier's ceiling at this point. But the one guy who I want to touch on before we move down, David Wright is going to be sort of a linchpin guy at the position this year. There are some that see him as a top five option, some that are just going to push him down just because of the down year and the injury. Scott, where do you fall on Wright this year? How nervous does he make you?
I'd be surprised if he's on any of my teams. Coming into his age 32 season, obviously in a big ballpark, I don't like the lineup around him. I get nervous about – for years you could pay for his stolen bases. But when a player gets into his 30s, a lot of times the wear and tear of stealing – and we're talking 10, 15, 20 bases – but a lot of times that wear and tear isn't worth it anymore, and that kind of fades from somebody's game. Give me Nolan Arenado. Granted, maybe I'm skipping two rounds of ADP there. It's an unfair comparison. But David Wright is somebody who makes me nervous, and I don't want to spend a top 10 pick on him, which means I probably won't get him.
Anyone take the counterpoint on Wright?
I'm with Scott. I'm really wary of Wright this year, so he pretty much echoed my sentiments.
All right. Well, I'm sort of on the counterpoint just because I think that where he is going now, and you know, he's a guy whose ADP was interesting to note because he was almost being taken outside of the top 100 picks, which is really surprising given his name value, even with the 2014 season. But I still think he's going to end up being a pretty good bargain where he's going.
I will say, Brett, like I'm looking at the NFBC in my ranks. I do think this. I think Wright, this is where I can kind of meet you guys in the middle. I do think Wright is kind of appropriately valued. He's coming in like toward the bottom of the top 100. There's guys, and we'll get to them in a little bit, and Chris Davis and Josh Harrison, you know, and for that matter, Chris Bryan's like right behind David Wright. I'd rather have Wright based on where he's going than Davis, Harrison, or Bryant. So there is something to that. You know, yes, I'd rather have Arenado or Longoria or Seager, but, you know, who wouldn't, you know, and they're all being appropriately priced. Like where Wright is sitting – I'm kind of okay with him. You know, I think, but I do think in every league, and particularly in an only or a deep mix, I think somebody's going to reach for Wright more than where he's going in the ADP, and that's kind of where I don't want him.
That's fair. So the three-star tier is a little more all over the place. We have, you know, guys who have been hyped, guys who have been very good, guys who have been at different positions, and then there's Josh Harrison. Harrison is the Harrison's sort of the, you know, where the hell do we put him guy. So where do we put him? Does he fit with this three-star group, or would you guys have him lower? Mike?
I'm fine with him here, and I think when we were debating him internally before the piece was put together, there were some that wanted to put him in that two-star tier. You know, my thinking about Harrison is this. He's going to slip this year. You know, we all know he's going to slip. You know, nobody thinks he's going to do the exact same thing. This kind of goes back to context. This is the context of he's very similar to someone like Matt Carpenter in that, you know, a little bit of power, a little bit of speed, a little bit of an all-around player. You know, Carpenter, if you kind of look at Carpenter in 2013 and 2014, that's kind of where I see the regression point for Harrison. You know, as I alluded to before, you know, Harrison, you know, his NFBC is about two rounds too high for me, which means I probably won't own him. I think people are paying too much of the freight for last year. But I don't see him slipping that much. I think he's a legitimate player. And I think in the current offensive context, you know, he'll be fine.
Anyone want to take the counterpoint that he should be in the two-star tier?
He's a tricky guy for me, man. You know, I look at his minor league pedigree, and it's actually better than I thought it was. 308, 358, 437. I think he's certainly going to have a job all year, and Pittsburgh would stick with him if he had any kind of a slump. I just don't trust the 13 homers. And when I see the 18 steals, but it's against seven caught stealings, that just makes me nervous that he starts out 2 for 5 and maybe the red light goes on. I think he's going to hit maybe around 280, 285, 8 homers. I just worry that you're going to give back some of the power. There's a good chance the speed isn't real. And even though I think he'll be a decent batting average guy, it's a 280 average, not a 315 average. Now, granted, I think some regression is priced into where he's at anyway. But I don't know. I just think at that price point, you can do better. There's guys I'm going to like more. There's guys I'm going to feel more safe about. So I guess he's kind of, this is going to be cheating, but I kind of think of him as like a 2.5-star guy for the sake of this tier argument.
No cheating.
Yeah, so you press me, I'll put him in the 2-star. If it has to be 2 or 3, I would lean towards 2.
Yeah, I'm with Scott there, but it's not. I wouldn't drop him, you know, to the bottom of the 2-star tier or anything. I think there are pitfalls everywhere with Harrison, and that's kind of the problem. There's not one number that he put up last year that I can confidently say I think he's going to get there again.
But again, it's a funny thing. He's 80. You know, his average rank in ADP is 89. You know, which puts him 84th overall. You know, in terms of how the players like slot out. And you know, that's where I'm just kind of not shocked, but surprised. Like that just seems too high to me based on everything we're saying. I just would rather get somebody else there who has, you know, as you'd say, Brett, you know, more of a carrying tool in either steals or power.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is the easiest way to cheat just by comparing players to cheaper options, but looking at the ADP, Harrison at 89, Wright or 98, I'd certainly take Wright at 98. I would certainly take Pablo Sandoval at 131, finally freed from San Francisco and to Fenway. It's obviously a great move for him. And even Matt Carpenter, who in some ways compares similarly to Harrison with a high average guy, you don't know how much power you're going to get. 133, that seems like a lot better deal than Harrison as well.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how much that ADP goes down over the course of the spring as people start to pump guys that are in the 100 to 150 range. I think they're gonna be guys jumping over Harrison. He's gonna sort of crumble a little bit underneath the weight of some of that.
Could you see Harrison outside the top 100? I think he'll be outside the top 100 when ADP solidifies a little bit more later in the spring.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
So let's go to Sandoval for a second. He's been an above average hitter every year of his career. Some years well above average, but that park has certainly inhibited him in the past. What do we think his performance on a raw number standpoint looks like in Boston as opposed to San Francisco? Mike,
put me on the spot first. Well, you know, the funny thing about Sandoval is he's one of those players who I could obviously see him getting a little bit better. But the really weird thing about him is he's actually been a better hitter at home throughout his career. The average has been higher. The home runs are kind of split. And I know you have to be careful with these arguments because the other side of this is that, you know, someone like Josh Hamilton, for example, when he left Texas, people were like, and he went to Anaheim, which was just an awful switch for him. People were like, oh, yeah, well, you know, he hit on the road. It's like, well, yeah, but he hit at home in an environment that was terrific. And that's the thing with Sandoval. He hit in an environment at home that was terrible. So I think he should get better. I just want to pump the brakes a little bit. You know, if you're thinking he's going to hit like 10 more home runs, you know, and be like a 30 home run guy, I just don't think that's who he is based on the swing and based on the profile. So I'm willing to bump him up a little bit, let's say, you know, 20, 22, 23 home runs. I just don't want to go crazy with that.
Yeah, I think the thing that's most likely to bump up in Boston isn't the home runs, but it's the batting average.
Yeah, I absolutely.
I think he's really well. I mean, he sort of tailored his game a little bit to AT&T for a good while, but you know, Fenway is the kind of park that should suit him very, very well as a guy who kind of just swings at everything, hits the ball all field, so he can take advantage of the different sort of peaks and valleys there. And
I mean, one thing about the power is I think he will enjoy that short right field porch, you know, because that's where most of the power profile for him has come from the last couple of years.
Yeah, what I want to add about Sandoval, it's really simple. The difference in scoring index between San Francisco and Boston last 3 years is 24%. It's, I think it's 16% tax in San Francisco. It's an 8% float in Fenway. And just being in the American League with a DH, with lineups that cycle through more often and in theory maybe less pitching to worry about, it's just an environment play for me.
The one thing I'll say about Sandoval is, you know, I know he hasn't missed too many games the last 2 years, but given the health profile in the past and given the fact that he's not an American League team where you can really cycle him into the DH because Poppy's there, that does concern me a little bit, but it's not a major concern. It's just kind of something of note, you know, as opposed to a team where, you know, the DH is somewhere like the Yankees, for example, where I think a bunch of guys are going to be cycled through and, you know, a guy who, you know, like Sandoval might need a rest can get that rest in the lineup as opposed to on the bench. You know, it's a minor thing, but it's just kind of something to note.
I also think one thing I try to be careful of is when somebody, most of the free agents who sign big deals in the offseason, it's so easy to bash the contract because a lot of them are going to look bad late in the deal. A lot of them are going to look bad in the middle of the deal. Some contracts will look bad right away. But obviously the way baseball payrolls work is you hope to get lucky with your cheap labor so you can overspend on the guys you have to overspend on to get. Sandoval may have – he's still just into his age 28 season. I mean, that body could look really bad. That contract could look really bad a few years down the road. I don't think it's going to look bad right away. I have no problem. I think he will be a health concern and a games concern and an attrition concern later in his career. But at age 28, I'm not going to worry about that.
That is very, very fair. He is a guy who is always younger than I think he is. Mostly just because he looks older than I think he is.
He came up really early too, if I remember correctly, in terms of his age.
Yeah. So let's move down to the two star tier. It's a smaller tier, but there are some interesting names, and probably the most interesting of them all is Chris Bryant. covered him a little bit before when we were talking about when we were floating in and out of the Javier Baez discussion. But there was quite a debate internally as to whether Bryant should be a one-star guy or a two-star guy. And for the most part, it came down to playing time. So I'm going to ask each of you, over under on Chris Bryant at bats this season. If I set it at 425, are you taking the over or the under? Mal?
I'm taking the over. I think they're going to be pretty aggressive with him this year. And I just, it's not a whole lot blocking him. So I'm going to go with the over.
Scott?
My knee jerk is always under, because I always think of these guys coming up in June. If the Cubs think they can win right away and Bryant's part of that, you know, I just can't see them easily giving up a year of control. So I think he comes up in June, and I think it's slightly under the 420.
Mike?
It's over for me. I just suspect that it could be, and I'm not saying he's the same player, but it could be that Evan Longoria situation where even if the Cubs conservatively play the service time game, I think you're still looking at May. But if he's up in the middle of end of April, as everybody said, you know, if he can contribute, if he gets off to a hot start, I think he'll be up. I don't even think opening is out of the question, because the Cubs don't seem like a team to me that is going to get too cute with that. But, you know, my guess is probably early May, so I'm going to go over.
Yeah, I'm going to go over. But I would be very, very surprised to see him in Chicago on opening day. I think there's too much at stake for the Cubs, for even if they keep him down for 3 weeks. I mean, they get an extra year of control if they keep him down for 3 weeks. So whether they want to, I don't think that they will keep him down until the Super 2 deadline is over. I think that is a little overblown, just because I don't think the Cubs are afraid to spend money if they think he can help now, and because they are looking to compete. I think his timing is going to be similar to what we saw with George Springer last year. And I think Springer got called up maybe with 2 or 3 days left in April, something like that, which would probably put him on pace for a little bit over 425.
And to tie Bryant into Longoria, Mike mentioned Longoria. This is just a gut feel of mine. My hunch is that Bryant will have a similar career path to Longoria, and that he'll be very good upon his call up. There won't be much of a learning curve. And I can just see Chicago thinking, okay, let's meet in the middle here. Let's buy out the arbitration years. Let's sign him to one of those young star long-term contracts where you get most of his year, you know, age 20 seasons. And I just gut feel hunch. I think Bryant is that ready. And I think the Cubs are the type of organization who could see that type of play making sense. And obviously they have tons of money. They've had it for a long time. So if they, and again, it's not like I know Jed Hoy or Theo Epstein personally, but if the Cubs do feel that way, then the whole idea of waiting goes out the window. If you think, okay, let's lock this guy up early as opposed to the later, when it's really going to be expensive.
Yeah. Jason Hayward was the other guy, you know, who pretty much, you know, for the Braves got that contract like right away, and the team decided, they're like, we know he's good enough. And I agree, Scott, that's very logical. That's something that could happen with Bryant, you know, and like you, I have no inside information.
So is there any other of these names in the two-star group that any of you guys want to touch before we play America's favorite game?
I'd like to touch briefly on Chase Headley. I think, you know, it's a small sample, but, you know, we kind of talked about Park with Sandoval. The move from out of Petco to anywhere is a nice move, but the move to Yankee Stadium, I think, out of Petco is a really nice move for Headley. The question with him is always health. He's always kind of banged up. But again, and I kind of mentioned this with the Yankees, you know, we won't talk about him because I don't even think he made the one star, but I really don't think Alex Rodriguez is going to have much of a role with the Yankees at all, which means that DH slot is going to be pretty open. And Headley could kind of use that along with other Yankees to get some rest, to keep his bat in the lineup. He's appropriately valued here, but I kind of see some sneaky power in that park and some sneaky speed. And I think he's going to be a little bit better than some people are thinking. Did I hedge my bets enough there with Headley?
I think you might have.
Yeah.
So let's jump into the one star group. So Scott, just for a little bit of background, we at the end of every episode, we each pick one guy in the one star tier. If we are forced to choose among this this group, so since you are our guest, we will let you choose first. So who, and you can also go off the board if you so choose. If there's a third baseman that is not covered in the entire column that that you want to go with, that is fair game. So who is the guy you would pick here?
I could live with Trevor Plouffe. 28 home runs the last 2 years. He walked more and struck out less last season, hit for an acceptable average. And Minnesota as a park is much more penal to the left-handed power guys than the right-handed power guys. And I think Minnesota's also going to play him. So I think he's a safe bet to repeat what he did, similar to what he did last year. And the upside is maybe he goes over 20 home runs again.
Sounds good. Mal, how about you?
I'm going to go against my profile here and what I usually go with, and I'm going to pick old man baseball, Juan Uribe. I think his last 2 years out in L.A. have been pretty solid. There's not a whole lot else here that I'm really attracted to. I'm certainly not going to be picking up Alex Rodriguez, so I'm just going to go with a guy that I like in Juan Uribe.
All right. Mike?
Do I have to? I really, you guys picked the two guys I would have picked. So, if I have to pick between a bunch of names I don't like here, I'm probably just going to go against the grain and pick Chris Johnson for the simple reason I know he's a horrible proposition at this point. We're talking about deeper mixed leagues, but in terms of his BABIP, last year was actually the anomaly. He's usually a very good hitter on balls in play, and while he was a little bit high, the ex-BABIP was kind of high in those years as well. So I think we really should see more of a 280, 285 profile, and with that, the rest of the numbers should bounce up a little bit. Again, this is really hedging your bets. I'm not talking about somebody great, but compared to everyone else here, I think he could be a slight value play. And as we've seen, he's got the contract. He'll stay on the field.
All right. So surprisingly, none of you guys took the guy I was going to take from this group. The guy I'm going to go with is David Freese. And there's sort of a philosophy that I attach to a bit, and that is when a player goes from the National League to the American League, there always is an adjustment period. Sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a year. Sometimes it's none at all. Freeze was terrible the first 2 months he was in Los Angeles after playing for the Cardinals forever. But from June 1st to the end of the season, he did hit .281, .343, .425 with 8 homers, 41 RBIs. Not fantastic, but considering the dearth of options at the bottom of the position, I'd be willing to throw a dollar or two on him and see whether the adjustments that he made in the last 4 months of the year he can carry forward. His strikeout rate is high. He's always going to be an injury risk, so he's certainly not someone who I would go out of my way to target. But we're not talking about guys that we would go out of our way to target now, are we? So that concludes this broadcast hour, as they say. So before we do our regular wrap up, I want to once again thank Scott Pienowski from Yahoo for joining us in our escapade around third baseman and beyond. So Scott, I'm gonna throw it out to you. You can talk about I believe Yahoo Fantasy Baseball is opening for the season shortly, and you can speak to that better than me. So the floor is yours.
Yahoo Fantasy Baseball will be opening. I'm told very soon. I don't know the exact date, but I'm excited about it. It's even before I got to Yahoo, it was my favorite place to play, and I hope you guys stop by. I think you'll like some of the changes they've done this year, and Yahoo's a great place to have a fantasy experience, make fake friends, come talk to me on Twitter, and thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and you guys have a lot of great, other people there, writing on the fantasy side as well. I always enjoy the content, without a doubt.
I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I mentioned Brad Evans earlier, but you know, Andy Behrens.
Yeah, Andy's who I was thinking of. Andy
charges the FSWA well. Now about as reasoned, as rational, and as great a writer you'll find. You know, Brandon Funston is the greatest boss to work with. Rob and Dalton Del Don is an excellent writer and a super guy too. So I love the people that I work with. And you know, if you don't care for my opinions or my style, check out those guys because they have a lot of opinions and style of their own.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that we don't really have to tell our listeners who these people are, since a lot of them play at Yahoo anyway, and they know who they are. They read stuff. So there's a lot of appetite for all of this content to go around. So again, thank you for joining us. We'll take a quick break and close things out. That concludes episode 40 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy podcast. I am Brett Sayer, and you have also been listening to Mike Gianella and Mauricio Rubio. And for this week, our special guest was Scott Pienowski of Yahoo. You should read all of us at baseballperspectives.com, where we are going through our positional series week by week. As you can tell by the last 40 minutes of content, we are on third base this week. So we have content covering everything from overviews of the positions to rankings in redraft, keeper, and dynasty formats, player profiles, prospect profiles. You name it, you think of it, we are covering it. So go to Baseball Prospectus today and subscribe. A premium membership will get you access to all of that, including Pecota, which is about to get released, and the Player Forecast Manager, which is always fun to roll out. You can customize that for your fantasy team and for your draft or auction. If you subscribe to a super premium membership, then you get access to the Bat Signal, which is our fantasy answering service. So you have a question for us, we will answer it generally within about 12 hours. That traffic is ramping up as we get closer to draft day, and it's always fun to see everyone's questions. Rate and review us on iTunes, email us flagsflyforever@baseballperspectus.com, and assuming we survive this incredible snowstorm we were supposed to get, we will see you next week for shortstops. So have a good evening. Bye bye.
See you next week.
See ya. Wow, shortstops is gonna be really depressing.
Yeah.
Yep.
That might be worse than catcher.
Well, that's why for all this talk of the risk on Tulo, I haven't ranked. I'm going to take the production and get